Coming up on Star Stuff, last-minute drama as New Horizons prepares for its rendezvous with Pluto. Meanwhile, mystery circles on Pluto's surface are baffling scientists. And new calculations claim an earlier, more violent end to the universe. All that and more coming up on Star Stuff.
This is Star Stuff.
In what sounds like a script straight out of a Hollywood thriller, NASA's New Horizons spacecraft suddenly lost all communications with Mission Control just 10 days out from its historic once-in-a-lifetime rendezvous with the dwarf planet Pluto. The probe experienced what NASA calls an anomaly on the afternoon of July the 4th, ironically American Independence Day, taking more than 4 hours to re-establish communications after the autopilot recognized the problem, placed the spacecraft in safe mode, and automatically switched to a backup computer. The mission's managers at Johns Hopkins University in Maryland say contact was lost at 1:54 p.m. U.S. Eastern Daylight Time and re-established 81 minutes later through NASA's Deep Space Communications Network. It seems ground controllers accidentally overloaded the spacecraft's primary computer, which was attempting to compress data to free up memory, while simultaneously installing the operating sequence for the Pluto encounter on its flash drive. Engineers were able to track down the problem and hustle through the procedures to prepare New Horizons for its close encounter with Pluto on July 14th. Diagnosis and recovery efforts were complicated by the 9-hour round-trip lag time to communicate with the spacecraft, which is nearly 5 billion kilometres from Earth. The final batch of software for the encounter was to be radioed to New Horizons on Sunday, but the glitch meant that was delayed until yesterday before returning the spacecraft to science operations. Incidentally, the glitch cost scientists about 30 observations of Pluto and its primary moon Charon, but scientists say that shouldn't affect the overall goals of the mission. The communications incident occurred just hours after NASA had given the final all clear for the probe's historic rendezvous with the Pluto system. After a journey which has lasted more than 9 years, the piano-sized spacecraft will make its closest approach to Pluto on July the 14th at 21:49:57 Australian Eastern Standard Time, 12,500 kilometres above the dwarf planet's frozen surface. NASA gave the all-clear after carefully studying the probe's planned trajectory, looking for any possible hazards such as dust clouds, rings, or small asteroids, any of which would be fatal to the mission. Mission scientists have been using the spacecraft's most powerful telescopic camera, the Long Range Reconnaissance Imager, or LORI, to look for potential hazards since May. And while it's good news for flight operators, astronomers admit they're surprised not to find any additional moons or rings in the Pluto system. New Horizons mission managers formed the hazard analysis team back in 2011 after the discovery of Pluto's fourth moon Kerberos raised concerns that the cratering of these moons by other Kuiper-belt objects could be spreading additional hazardous debris into New Horizons' path. Mission engineers then retested spare spacecraft blanketing and parts to determine just how well they'd stand up to particle impacts. Scientists also modelled the likely formation and location of rings and debris in the Pluto system. And by the time New Horizons cameras were close enough to Pluto to begin searching, the team had already estimated the chances of a catastrophic incident at far less than 1%. The images used in the latest search, which cleared the mission to stay on its current course, were taken on June the 22nd, 23rd and 26th. Pluto and all five of its known moons are now visible in these images, but scientists saw no rings, no new moons, and thankfully no hazards of any kind. The 478-kilogram spacecraft is undertaking humanity's first mission to Pluto and the Kuiper Belt. All previous missions to the edge of the solar system by the Pioneer 10 and 11 probes and the Voyagers 1 and 2 spacecraft travelled in different directions, avoiding the densely packed Kuiper Belt. New Horizons is designed to help scientists understand the formation of Pluto and the Kuiper Belt and how this all fits in with the early evolution of the solar system. The scientific package aboard the spacecraft will study the atmospheres, surface features, geology and environments of Pluto, its many moons and other Kuiper Belt objects. The probe will map Pluto's surface and examine the geology and morphology of both Pluto and its largest moon and binary partner, Charon, including detailed maps of the surface temperatures of both worlds. It will also study Pluto's atmosphere and search for an atmosphere around Charon. After leaving Pluto, New Horizons will conduct similar investigations of other Kuiper-belt objects along its trajectory. The CSIRO's Glenn Nagel from NASA's Canberra Tracking Station says the agency's deep space network has been preparing for Tuesday's encounter for almost a decade.
Well, with less than a week to go to this amazing historic encounter by the New Horizons spacecraft with Pluto, our tracking station is all hands on deck. Everything is in readiness. We've been, for the last month, actually in a what we call a configuration freeze, meaning we do not change any systems. We don't try to do any major upgrades. We just make sure every piece of equipment is ready. We're making sure our personnel are ready. There'll be backups to make sure that Australia can help NASA receive these first amazing images from a whole new world for the very first time.
Now, New Horizons, of course, it's Pluto encounter. It's a once-in-a-lifetime event. It's not just the Australian tracking stations that are involved. It's the entire DSN network, isn't it?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. In fact, the whole network, so our three stations, our station here in Canberra run by the CSIRO, tracking station over in Spain, and one in California, we're all prepared for what is not just once in a lifetime, but a once in a many lifetimes opportunity to actually do this, because it really is essential that the planets are actually in the right place to allow a spacecraft to hurtle across the solar system, get a gravity kick from, a world like Jupiter, to get out to Pluto when Pluto's orbit is crossing the orbit of all the other planets. So we might not get a chance to do this for many generations. The Deep Space Network, NASA's three stations around the world, have the prime responsibility for New Horizons. It is enormous distance that it is away from Earth at nearly 5 billion kilometres. It's the unique capabilities, the sensitivity of our dishes that is going to be used for this historic encounter.
Now, you guys have just had a dish upgrade, haven't you?
Yeah, so we've done a number of upgrades to our dishes over the years. In fact, we prepared back in 2011 for big upgrades to our main dish, our 70-metre antenna, Deep Space Station 43. We've just last October commissioned a brand new dish here on site, a new 34-metre antenna. And we're actually halfway through the construction of an additional antenna, which will be used for future missions. But yeah, we needed these new antennas in place to really give us these additional capabilities to talk to not only New Horizon, but a whole plethora of other spacecraft across the solar system.
Actual countdown to the event. Can you just run through what happens when, as New Horizons gets closer to the Pluto system?
Yeah, of course, this has been a 9.5-year journey, but after this huge voyage, the spacecraft literally only gets about 24 hours. In fact, actually even less, probably about 10 hours to do all of its critical science. So in the days on approach, there'll be sort of the final on approach images, and there's an exciting one that'll be coming out around about 16 hours before time of closest approach. And then the spacecraft will essentially then go out of contact with Earth. It's pre-programmed to use all of its instruments, turning the spacecraft to look at the planet, to look at its moons, to understand more about its atmosphere, to learn about the surface composition. So it's going to be busy collecting data. And the critical moment, I think, that everybody will be having a bit of a sense of relief, that sort of yay moment, will be about 5 hours after closest approach. New Horizons sends a signal back home. We call it the e-health signal. It's basically to say, I'm alive. I've survived. The encounter is over. And then data will start streaming back at a blistering pace of between about 1 to 2 bits per second, an incredibly low data rate from this enormous distance away. And it will take, you know, many, many days to get sort of all the initial data back, but then actually starting from September up to a year to actually get all of the information back, the thousands of images, all of the observation work back from this little tiny piano-sized spacecraft, now well beyond Pluto.
And I take it it's going to be even longer for scientists to sift through all those reams of data and actually provide some new information and some new insights into this distant world.
Yeah, in fact, it's been exciting that they're already on the approach. There has been some interesting discoveries, some confirmation of previous observations, but actually now sort of better knowledge about the surface and markings on the surface. But getting all the detail back and understanding what all of these things actually mean in the whole context of the Pluto system and its relationship to the other planets of the solar system, that will take some years to come.
That's the CSIRO's Glenn Nagel from NASA's Canberra Deep Space Tracking Station. Meanwhile, scientists are at a loss to explain a mysterious row of four strange dark spots discovered on the frozen surface of Pluto in new images taken by New Horizon. The intriguing spots are remarkably consistent in both their even spacing along the dwarf planet's equator and also their shape and size. Each spot appears to be a perfect circle, about 480 kilometres in diameter. New Horizons principal investigator Dr. Alan Stern from the Southwest Research Institute in Boulder, Colorado, says the spots are a real puzzle. He says scientists have no idea as to what they are, but can't wait to find out. The strange spots were detected in new images of Pluto and its binary partner Charon taken by New Horizons on June the 25th and 27th. The new pictures, which combine black and white images of Pluto and Charon taken by the LORI camera with low-resolution colour data from the probe's RALPH instrument, show Pluto to have two remarkably different faces. One image shows the side of Pluto that will be seen in highest resolution when New Horizons makes its closest approach. That hemisphere is dominated by a very dark region extending along the equator. The second image shows the hemisphere of Pluto facing Charon, with the row of dark, strange spots clearly visible along the equator. Stern says just as puzzling as the spots is the long-standing dramatic difference in the colours and appearance of Pluto compared to its darker and greyer moon, Charon. Another mystery which hopefully will start to be solved in the next few days. New research from Rosetta's mission to comet 67P Sheremov-Gerasimenko has concluded that mysterious pits seen on the surface of comets are actually sinkholes created by the collapse of subterranean cavities. The findings reported in the journal Nature show how dynamic comets are, undergoing dramatic changes as they get closer to the sun. The pits, which can be up to 200 metres wide and 160 metres deep, have been seen on numerous comets, but they've never been adequately explained. One of the new study's authors, Dr. Dennis Bodwitz from the University of Maryland, says the pits are formed when ices in comets sublimate into gases below the surface, creating a cavity which grows until the ceiling can no longer support its own mass and collapses. And because the ceiling's pulling down in the middle, it creates a circular hole. On Earth, similar sinkholes occur when subsurface erosion removes large amounts of material beneath the surface, creating a cavern. Astronomers believe comets are ancient leftovers from the formation of the solar system 4.567 billion years ago, and so they retain a record of the chemistry and the physical conditions that existed back at that time. Comets spend most of their lives in the dark, frozen outer reaches of the solar system, or even further out in interstellar space. When comets approach the sun and begin to heat up, volatile gases such as water, carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide begin to sublimate, turning from solid ice directly into a gas. These gases and the dust they take with them are what produces a comet's fantastic coma and fabulous tails. The European Space Agency's Rosetta spacecraft became the first probe to orbit a comet when it began circling 67P back in August 2014. Close-up images from Rosetta's OSIRIS imaging system have identified 18 pits on the surface of comet 67P, some of which were producing jets of gas and dust as heat from the sun causes the ices to sublimate from the pit walls and floors. Bodwitz and colleagues identified two distinct types of pits, deep ones with steep sides, and shallower pits similar to the ones seen in other comets, including 9P Tempel 1 and 81P Vilt 2. However, the authors only detected gas and dust streaming out of the really deep, steep-sided pits, which they believe are younger and so are exposing fresh comet ices to sunlight for the first time, causing the ice chunks to begin sublimating immediately. Bodwitz thinks the shallower pits are older sinkholes, with more thoroughly eroded sidewalls and bottoms that have been filled in by dust and chunks of material. The authors have raised three possible scenarios to describe how the cavities are being produced in the first place. The first involves amorphous water ice under the surface changing phase to form crystalline ice, in the process releasing energy as heat as a byproduct which sublimes gases. Now, amorphous ice, in which water molecules are arranged in a random order, is common in space. On the other hand, crystalline ice, which consists of water molecules arranged in geometrically repeating patterns, is commonly found on Earth in things like snow, polar ice caps, and refrigerator freezers when they're not defrosted properly. Crystallization of ice has been used to explain distant outbursts seen on comet 1P Halley and comet 17P Holmes, as well as the chaotic behavior of comet 29P Schwarzschild-Wachmann. The authors calculate pits the size of those seen on comet 67P could have been produced by the phase transition of around 600 kilograms of amorphous ice, which they describe as being about the size of a sphere, 2 meters in diameter. Alternatively, the cavities could be formed by other ices such as carbon monoxide or carbon dioxide, which would sublimate at lower temperatures more easily than water. The third possibility involves the very porous structure of cometary interiors themselves. Birdwitz describes comets as forming a bit like Swiss cheese, where you have holes throughout the body, and just one of those holes needs to grow just a little bit by removing a bit of ice, and you wind up forming a pit. Initially, the authors suspected sudden explosive events as ice degassing may have created the pits. In fact, Rosetta observed one such outburst, producing about 100,000 kilograms of debris as the spacecraft approached the comet back on April the 30th last year. But when the authors calculated the volume of the holes, they realized that they contained far more material than was expelled by the explosion. Consequently, something else had to be driving the formation of the pits. So it seems the outbursts aren't the driving forces of the process, but are instead one of the consequences. The new study also dismissed earlier theories that the pits were impact craters caused through collisions. The problem with the impact theory is that comet orbits don't intersect a lot of meteoroids or asteroids, so there's less chances of a collision on a cometary orbit compared to asteroid orbits. Also, the size distribution of craters caused by asteroid impacts would result in many more small craters than larger ones, whereas the pits we're seeing on the surface of comets all seem to be about the same size. And that could be telling scientists something more about the materials making up the comet's composition rather than anything else. Birdwitz hopes news that Rosetta's comet lander Philae has reactivated will provide his team with a new stream of data on the internal structure of 67P as the comet moves towards perihelion on August the 13th this year, the closest point to the Sun in its six-year orbit through the solar system.
My research has been much about what was also at the core of the Rosetta mission, and that's quite simple. How do comets work and how do they age? We now know that comets are not simple snowballs that sublimate. They are much more complex.
You're specifically focusing on the pits on the surface of comets.
So these pits are really strange holes. They're almost perfectly circular. You can peer right into them. They have a very interesting texture on the wall. They're about 100 meters in diameter, and some of them are as deep as they are wide. Others are less shallow. You can see right through at the bottom sometimes, and they seem to be clustered. You always find them in little groups.
The speculation was these could be impact craters, but that's not likely, is it? It's more likely that they're something else.
That's right. At the orbits that comets have, you simply don't sweep up a lot of material. You don't have a lot of collisions that you would have like you have on asteroids. And if you had, you get a size distribution because, of course, you're more likely to encounter the small dust, small particles than the larger stuff.
And so what do you think these pits are? I mean, the standard explanation has been if they're not impact craters, they're probably an ejection source where the jets which provide the comet with its halo and its beautiful tails, where that originates from.
That's what we thought was first. And particularly when we flew to the comet in the spring of last year, this comet 67P, it had a major outburst of about 100,000 kilograms of material. And we thought like, ha, gotcha, these holes. They got to be related to those outbursts. But when you do the math, these holes would contain much more material than was expelled by the explosion. So even a 100,000 kilogram explosion would result in only a very small cylindrical hole. And our camera is really good. If you had these kind of small holes, we would have seen them. So something else had to drive the formation of these holes.
And that's what you've been researching, isn't it, what these pits could actually be? And you're looking at, well, you know, here on Earth we call them sinkholes.
That's correct. But we think what happens is that you do have a lot of ice in comets, and when this ice is removed below the surface, eventually you're going to create a scenario where the ceiling can no longer support itself and it collapses. And because this is like pulling it down from the middle, you get this circular hole. And because this really depends on the surface properties of the material of a comet, all of them will be about the same size.
And that's what you're seeing. You're seeing these holes are all very similar in size in specific places. And that would be indicative of the composition of the material underneath in that area of the comet.
That's right. So what we get here is a glimpse under the surface of comets. And it tells us that because these holes are centered in certain regions, focused in certain regions, that the inside of comets is not homogeneous.
You can tell something about the age of a pit by the shape of the structure, can't you?
Yeah, so when we started looking further into this, what we noticed is that you have, on one hand, pits that are as wide as they are deep, and on the other hand, you have pits that are much shallower. And looking into more depth, we found that there were jets coming from the sides of those deeper pits, but not from the shallower ones. So what we think will happen is that over time, you fill in those pits, and they get shallower. There's materials blowing around, the walls are crumbling, they may get wider because the walls are crumbling, There you go.
And you've come up with three possible scenarios as to how the material, which disappears from below the surface to allow the pit to form in the first place, how that material disappears.
That's correct. We have not seen one of those holes being formed. That, of course, would be a scenario that we dream of, to see this happening on the surface. And we're observing the comet all the time, so it may happen. But until then, we can only speculate on what was the exact scenario that formed them.
And what are the sort of scenarios you're looking at? There were three you described in the paper.
Yeah, that's correct. What we think is the most likely scenario is that there is a material under the surface which is called amorphous ice. And this ice, when it gets heated, it triggers an explosion-like event where it transforms into another ice and it releases heat. And with that, you could sublime gases. But this is a difficult idea. It's not been proven well. It's not been tested very well in the laboratory, and it's been debated for over two decades. Alternatively, you could have a large amount of ice that sublimes easier than water, for example, CO2 and CO, on a spot under the comet, and it could be removed. And then thirdly, people say that comets are formed like Swiss cheese, where you just have holes throughout the entire body, and one of those could just grow a little bit by removing a little bit of ice, and you would form those holes.
Now to the ultimate fate of our universe. There used to be three options: the Big Crunch, the Big Freeze, and the Big Rip. The Big Crunch involved the universe expanding out from the Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago, with that rate of expansion gradually slowing down under the influence of gravity. Eventually, the force of gravity would dominate, causing the expansion to reverse into a runaway contraction, which scientists called the Big Crunch. That would be followed by possibly more cycles of Big Bangs and Big Crunches. And so it goes on. Then in the 1990s, the physics community was shocked when astronomical measurements based on a type of exploding star called a thermonuclear or type 1a supernovae showed that rather than slowing down, the universe's rate of expansion was actually accelerating due to some unknown repulsive force, which they labeled dark energy because they knew absolutely nothing about it. Now, depending on the strength of dark energy, this meant the universe would probably keep expanding forever in what scientists called the Big Freeze. The Big Freeze predicts that after maybe 100 trillion years or so, the universe will have grown so vast that the supplies of gas will become too thin for new stars to form. All the existing stars will then gradually burn out one by one, turning the universe dark and ending the cosmos's stelliferous epoch. All that then will be left will be black holes, which themselves will slowly evaporate away thanks to Hawking radiation as space itself gets colder and colder, resulting in a big freeze. Now, scientists at Vanderbilt University have come up with a fundamentally new mathematical formulation which reconciles the classic notion of viscosity based on the laws of thermodynamics with Albert Einstein's general theory of relativity. And the results, if confirmed, will have significant implications for the ultimate fate of the universe, because it tends to favour the third of our options for the universe's ultimate fate, the so-called Big Rip. In the process, it also sheds new light on the basic nature of dark energy. The new approach, reported in the journal Physical Review Letters D, was developed by Assistant Professor of Mathematics Marcello De Conzi in collaboration with physics professors Thomas Kephart and Robert Shearer. In fact, Shearer describes De Conzi's formulation as being simple, elegant, mathematically sound, and obeying all the applicable physical laws. The type of viscosity that they're talking about in terms of cosmology is different from the rather familiar ketchup form of viscosity that you and I think of. That's called shear viscosity, and it's a measure of a fluid's resistance to flowing through small openings like the neck of a ketchup bottle. Instead, cosmological viscosity is a form of bulk viscosity, which is a measure of fluid's resistance to expansion or contraction. Now, the reason scientists don't often deal with bulk viscosity in everyday life is because most liquids we encounter can't be compressed or expanded very much. De Conzi began by tackling the problem of relativistic fluids. Astronomical objects that produce this phenomenon include supernovae and some of their byproducts called neutron stars, which have extreme densities of over a billion tons per cubic centimeter. Scientists have had considerable success modeling what happens when ideal fluids, those with no viscosity, are boosted to near light speeds. But almost all fluids are viscous in nature, and despite decades of effort, no one's managed to come up with a generally accepted way of handling viscous fluids travelling at relativistic velocities, that is, velocities close to the speed of light. In the past, models designed to predict what happens when relativistic fluids are accelerated to within a fraction of light speed have been plagued with inconsistencies. The most glaring being predicting conditions where these fluids could travel faster than the speed of light. And of course, that's impossible. It's generally accepted that only massless particles such as photons can travel at the speed of light, and only the expansion of the universe itself exceeds light travel. Descartes' new maths has produced some interesting results, including some potential new insights into the very nature of dark energy. The authors say most dark energy theories to date have not taken cosmic viscosity into account, despite it having a repulsive effect very similar to that of dark energy. Descartes believes it's possible that viscosity could account for all the acceleration that's been attributed in the past to dark energy. But he thinks it's more likely that a significant fraction of the acceleration could be due to more prosaic causes. As a result, viscosity may act as an important constraint on the properties of dark energy. And that has implications for the ultimate fate of the universe. The Big Rip scenario is predicated on dark energy continuing to get even stronger over time. In the Big Rip future, the expansion rate of the universe becomes so great that in about 22 billion years from now, dark energy becomes so strong that it doesn't just cause galaxies and stars to move away from each other as space-time expands, but the same force also acts on matter at the quantum scale, so even atoms are ripped apart, resulting in ultimately a universe of nothing but elemental particles, such as free-floating quarks, electrons, and radiation. The key value for the Big Rip is a ratio between dark energy's pressure and density, known as the equation of state parameter. Now, if this value drops below minus 1, what cosmologists call the phantom barrier, then the universe's ultimate fate will be a Big Rip. Previous viscosity models couldn't evolve beyond this limit, but the barrier doesn't exist in the Descartes-Kefauver-Shearer model. Instead, viscosity actually drives the equation of state parameter to fall below minus 1. The authors say the results of their pen and paper analysis of this new formulation for relativistic viscosity is promising, but they do stress that a much deeper analysis must be carried out in order to determine its viability. The only way to do this is to use powerful computers to analyze the complex equations numerically. Needless to say, we'll keep you informed. Well, it's been hard to miss, even in the heart of a brightly lit city. But even the casual observer couldn't help but notice the spectacular conjunction of Venus and Jupiter side by side in the evening sky. The planets, which are now the constellation Leo, have been slowly moving together over the past few weeks. They finally appeared at the closest on the evening of July 1st, when they were less than a third of a degree apart, looking like a double star and close enough to allow you to cover both of them with the tip of your little finger. The bigger and brighter of the pair is Venus, Earth's sister planet, which is also the brightest object in the sky after the Sun and Moon. Right now, Venus is about 77 million kilometers away. A backyard telescope shows Venus appearing as a brilliant crescent with one side lit by the Sun. The smaller looking and fainter of the pair is the giant gas planet Jupiter, the largest planet in our solar system. It looks smaller and fainter because it's some 909 million kilometers away, 12 times more distant than Venus. A backyard telescope will let you see not just Jupiter, but also its four big Galilean moons, Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto, so named because they were discovered by Galileo Galilei in about 1610 and were the first group of objects found orbiting another planet, proof, much to the Vatican's disgust, that the Earth was not the center of the universe. Venus and Jupiter are now starting to move apart again. But don't worry, celestial conjunctions of Venus and Jupiter aren't particularly rare. They appeared even closer, although not as high in the sky, just before dawn on August the 18th last year. And they'll come into conjunction again before dawn on October the 26th, when they'll be separated by about 1 degree. There'll be an even more spectacular evening conjunction on the night of August the 27th next year, when the pair will be separated by just 1/10 of a degree. Steve Harley is from the Astronomical Society.
Venus is a blazing bright yellow, and just beside it is Jupiter, which is a sort of a gold yellow, and Venus is the brighter of the two. And if it's a clear night with a jet black background, you know, they are standing out strongly, much brighter than any stars.
And that's the show for now. If you're in the United States and you're listening to Star Stuff as a radio broadcast, don't forget you can ensure that you never miss an episode by subscribing to the show as a free weekly podcast through iTunes. Just type in ABC Star Stuff in the search box and click subscribe. or you can download the show from the ABC Science website at abc.net.au/science/starstuff. We also have a Star Stuff blog containing all the space and astronomy news we can't fit in the show, as well as some spectacular spacey images and other things I find amusing on the net. Just Google starstuffblog.tumblr.com. That's all one word and in lowercase, and that's Tumblr without the E. And for the latest Star Stuff broadcast times, radio stations and publishing details, join the official ABC Star Stuff Twitter feed. Just type in the at symbol followed by ABC Star Stuff, all one word and in lowercase, and you'll never miss a thing.